Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. We have a special treat this week. We have the Greatest Hit Show number 7. Greatest Hit Shows are compilations of timeless and timely public health stories that I've reported on early. This Greatest Hit Show number 7 features stories from May through August of 2021. Let's get to it. Okay, well, next up, I want to do a couple of stories on something that's underreported and underappreciated in health and public health. That is sleep. This from Science Daily. New position statement declares that sleep is essential to health. A new position statement from the American Academy of Sleep Medicine emphasizes that sleep is a biological necessity, and insufficient sleep and untreated sleep disorders are detrimental for health, well-being, and public safety. Published online in the Journal of Clinical Sleep Medicine, the statement notes that sleep is vital for health and well-being in children, adolescents, and adults. While awareness of the value of sleep has risen in the last decade, there is a significant need for greater emphasis on sleep health in education, clinical practice, inpatient and long-term care, public health promotion, and the workplace. Healthy sleep is as important as proper nutrition and regular exercise for our health and well-being, and sleep is critical for performance and safety, said American Associate Academy of Sleep Medicine President Dr. Kanan Ramar. It is the position of the Academy that sleep is essential to health, and we are urging educators, healthcare professionals, government agencies, and employers to prioritize the promotion of healthy sleep. The statement was written by members of the 2020 Academy Board of Directors, comprising 11 sleep medicine physicians and a clinical psychologist. In recognition of sleep's significant and multifaceted connections to health and chronic disease, the authors outlined the following positions. Sleep education should have a prominent place in K-12 and college health education, medical school and graduate medical education, and education programs for other health professionals. Clinicians should routinely inquire about sleep habits and symptoms of sleep and circadian rhythm sleep-wake disorders during patient encounters, and hospitals and long-term care facilities should optimize sleep conditions. Healthy sleep should be targeted by public health and workplace interventions to improve health-related outcomes, and behaviors that help people attain healthy sleep should be actively promoted. More sleep and circadian research is needed to further elucidate the importance of sleep for public health and the contributions of insufficient sleep to health disparities. Education about sleep and sleep disorders is lacking in medical school curricula, graduate medical education, and education programs for other health professionals, said Ramar. Better sleep health education will enable our healthcare workforce to provide more patient-centered care for people of common sleep disorders such as obstructive sleep apnea and insomnia. According to the authors, chronic insufficient sleep and untreated sleep disorders are linked to increased health and safety risks, such as cardiovascular disease, diabetes, obesity, workplace accidents, and motor vehicle crashes. Data from surveys conducted by the CDC and the Maternal Child Health Bureau showed that 34% of children, 75% of high school students, and 35% of adults in the U.S. fail to get sufficient duration of sleep on a regular basis. Therefore, helping people to get enough sleep is one of the goals of the Healthy People 2030, which provides 10-year measurable public health objectives for the U.S. Okay, so what might you be able to do to improve your good night's rest? This from Medical Express. Better sleep, less fast food and screen time, more physical activity. Getting a good night's rest is essential to our physical and mental health. But what behaviors lead to healthy sleep? And do those lifestyle factors change as we get older? A new study by researchers at Virginia Commonwealth University has investigated the sleep, lifestyle, and health of over 3,000 adults. It found that behaviors directly under our control, such as diet, how physically active or sedentary we are, and how much time we spend watching TV, reading, or in the internet, and on social media, are associated with sleep health across the lifespan. For decades, sleep medicine has focused exclusively on disordered sleep to the exclusion of healthy sleep. Sleep health is a newer concept that incorporates factors thought to be associated with the positive experiences of sleep, said lead author Joseph Dzerzhinsky, an associate professor in the Department of Psychology in the College of Humanities and Sciences at the Virginia Commonwealth University. Understanding factors associated with good sleep, as opposed to corrective actions for poor sleep, could have important implications for the general population. The study, Lifestyle Factors in Sleep Health Across the Lifespan, was published in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health as part of a special issue on sleep quality, well-being, and mental health among adults. It found that older adults reported the highest amount of sleep health, followed by middle age and younger adults. Across age groups, fast food consumption, sedentary behavior, daytime activity irregularity, and exposure to media, including daily TV minutes, social media usage, and internet usage, correlated negatively with sleep health. The finding that sleep health was highest in older adults as compared to young and middle-aged adults also was notable. This finding is in contrast to decades of research showing that older adults have higher rates of virtually all sleep disorders. The study results imply that eating less fast food, watching less TV, spending less time on the internet broadly, and social media specifically, along with living a regular lifestyle, all may help promote high-quality, healthy sleep, he said. Next up from The Hill, America's unhealthy lifestyles. Despite the remarkable improvements in U.S. mortality levels and longevity during the 20th century, America's unhealthy lifestyles are undermining the nation's well-being and imperiling its future. In addition to inflicting a sizable human toll, unhealthy lifestyles are exacting substantial costs from families, employers, and the U.S. economy. Over the last 40 years, America's life expectancy has fallen behind those of other developed nations that culminated in an unprecedented decline in longevity since 2014. Recent declines in life expectancy were driven by increasing mortality rates among working-age adults, specifically those of lower socioeconomic status. Also, noteworthy differentials in life expectancy at birth have persisted among America's major groups, namely Hispanics at 81.8 years, whites 78.8 years, and blacks at 74.7 years. Prior to the pandemic, America's life expectancy at birth of 78.8 years lagged behind the levels of many other developed countries. Life expectancy at birth above 83 years, for example, were experienced in Australia, Italy, Japan, Spain, and Switzerland. Many social, economic, and political factors are behind the comparatively lower levels and recent declines in U.S. life expectancies, including the absence of universal health care, public health crises, inadequate federal drug oversight, lower levels of educational attainment, deindustrialization of American jobs, systemic racism, and unhealthy lifestyles. Particularly noteworthy, unhealthy lifestyles that are contributing to rising levels of preventable deaths are cigarette smoking, obesity, alcohol misuse, and drug overdoses. Cigarette smoking is the leading cause of preventable deaths in the U.S., with nearly 500,000 deaths per year and smokers dying 10 years earlier than non-smokers. For every American dying from smoking, no less than 30 others live with a serious smoking-related illness, including cancer, heart disease, stroke, and various lung diseases. The economic cost of smoking is more than $300 billion annually. Most of that cost, close to 60%, is for direct care, and more than $156 billion is incurred by lost productivity due to premature death. In 2018, approximately 14% of American adults, or 34 million people, age 18 years or older, were cigarette smokers. The proportion was higher among men than women, 16% versus 12%, respectively. If smoking continues at its current level among U.S. youth, nearly 6 million Americans below the age of 18 are expected to die prematurely from a smoking-related illness. The second leading cause of preventable deaths is obesity. It is largely the result of poor diet and physical inactivity and related to reduced quality of life and various health conditions, including heart disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes, arthritis and joint disorders, clinical depression, and some cancers. Among OECD countries, America has the highest percentage of obesity among adults, approximately 42%. In contrast, the rates of many countries are a fraction of America's percentage, including Italy, Japan, and South Korea, all at less than 10%. America's levels of obesity are estimated to account for about half of its shortfall in life expectancy compared to other developed countries. Also, obesity is associated with poorer mental health, greater difficulties with physical functioning, and higher medical costs than people with healthy weight. From 1999 to 2018, the prevalence of obesity in American adults increased from 31 to 42%, with severe obesity nearly doubling from 5 to 9%. While there are no significant differences between men and women, the adult obesity prevalence percentages among major groups varied considerably, with Asians 17%, whites 42%, Hispanics 45%, and blacks 50%. Nearly 100,000 Americans, two-thirds being men, die from alcohol-related deaths annually. This level of mortality makes alcohol the third leading cause of preventable deaths in America. While the U.S. has one of the lowest alcohol use rates per capita among developed countries, with Australia, France, Germany, and United Kingdom having higher rates, America has higher levels of alcohol abuse than those countries. It is estimated that 6% of American adults, approximately 15 million people, struggle with an alcohol use disorder, with men having twice the level of women. Among teenagers, more than 600,000 have alcohol use disorders. Over the past 20 years, drug overdose mortality has more than tripled and reached unprecedented levels. According to the CDC, drug overdose has become the leading cause of U.S. injury death, more numerous than motor vehicle deaths and homicides. Mortality due to drug overdose has continued to rise. In 2017, drug overdose resulted in more than 70,000 deaths, an increase of 16% on the level in 2014. Approximately two-thirds of those deaths were due to opioid overdose, now accounting to more than 130 American deaths every day. Due to mounting demand for drugs to address physical, mental, and psychological pain, and absent sufficient federal oversight, drug companies marketed pain relievers during the 1990s that fueled the overdoses of prescription opioids. As a result, American death rates from drug overdose increased markedly over the past two decades and are higher than European rates. In terms of mortality levels, the United States, despite its wealth, resources, and being the world's largest economy, lags behind many developed countries. With respect to life expectancy at birth, America is not even among the top 20 countries. No amount of political rhetoric, partisan spin, or party fealty can alter such demographic realities. To address America's lagging mortality rates, various recommendations have been offered to researchers, academies, foundations, and other organizations. In addition, valuable lessons may be gained from the health experiences of leading developed countries. Among the many factors behind America's comparatively high mortality rates, unhealthy lifestyles certainly play an important role. Much needs to be done by political leaders, the private sector, and non-governmental organizations, and the public to modify America's unhealthy lifestyles, particularly adopting more effective measures to address smoking, obesity, alcohol misuse, and drug overdose. Failing to address America's unhealthy lifestyles not only contributes to undermining the country's current well-being, but it also imperils America's future. Okay, and what could be seen as a sad day in women's equality? This from Medical Express. Women now drink as much as men. For nearly a century, women have been closing the gender gap in alcohol consumption, binge drinking, and alcohol use disorder. What was previously a 3-to-1 ratio for risking drinking habits in men versus women is closer to 1-to-1 globally, a 2016 analysis of several studies suggested. And the latest U.S. data from 2019 shows that women in their teens and early 20s reported drinking and getting drunk at higher rates than their male peers, in some cases for the first time since researchers began measuring such behavior. This trend parallels the rise in mental health concerns among young women, and researchers worry the long-term effects of the COVID-19 pandemic could amplify both patterns. It's not only that we're seeing women drinking more, but that they're really being affected by this physically and mental health-wise, said Dawn Sugarman, a research psychologist at McLean Hospital in Massachusetts who has studied addiction in women. Research shows women suffer health consequences of alcohol, liver disease, heart disease, and cancer, more quickly than men, and even at lower levels of consumption. Perhaps most concerning is that the rising gender equality in alcohol use doesn't extend to the recognition or treatment of alcohol disorders, Sugarman said. So even as some women drink more, they're often less likely to get the help they need. Research suggests that people who drink to cope, as opposed to drinking for pleasure, have a higher risk of developing alcohol use disorder. And while every individual's reasons for drinking are different, studies have found women are more likely to drink to cope than men. Women are statistically more likely to experience childhood abuse or sexual assault than men. In recent years, studies have found rates of depression, anxiety, eating disorders, and suicide are climbing among teenage and young adult women. That could be driving their alcohol use. And the layers of stress, isolation, and trauma from COVID-19 could make things worse. One study that looked at alcohol's effect on college students early in the pandemic found increased alcohol use among those who reported higher levels of stress and anxiety. And several studies found women were more likely to report rises in drinking during the pandemic, especially if they experienced increased stress. For us to address issues with alcohol, we also need to address these pervasive issues with mental health. They are all related. What's more, despite alcohol's temporary calming properties, it actually increases anxiety. And studies show it causes brain damage and may lead to depression more quickly in women than in men. Until the 1990s, most research on alcohol focused on men. Now, as women approach parity in drinking habits, scientists are uncovering more about the unequal damage alcohol causes to their bodies. Women generally have less body water, which dissolves alcohol, than men of the same weight. That means the same number of drinks leads to higher concentrations of alcohol in the blood, and their body tissues are exposed to more alcohol per drink. The result? From less years of alcohol use, women are getting sicker faster. They're at greater risk for hangovers, blackouts, liver disease, alcohol-induced cardiovascular diseases, and certain cancers. One study found alcohol-related visits to the emergency room from 2006 to 2014 increased 70% for women compared to 58% for men. Another paper reported that the rate of alcohol-related cirrhosis rose 50% for women versus 30% for men from 2009 to 2015. And I would note that those are both big increases for both men and women. They're just somewhat faster for women. This is just another reminder that in the U.S., one of the stickiest problems that we have in public health regarding quality of life and just longevity are these diseases of despair. And alcohol use disorder and abuse falls into that category. This from Medical Express. Beyond remission, from alcohol dependence to optimal mental health. New research published online in this journal, Substance Use and Misuse, is good news for those struggling with alcohol dependence. The possibility of ending this dependency gets easier with age. Moreover, more than half of individuals who have been dependent on alcohol are free of any addictions or mental illness, and nearly 40% are in excellent mental health. Using data drawn from Statistics Canada's Canadian Community Health Survey Mental Health, researchers examined a nationally representative sample of 820 adult Canadians with a history of alcohol dependence to 19,945 who have never been addicted to alcohol. They found that in the past year, 71% of those with a history of alcohol dependence were no longer dependent, 52% were free from any addictions or mental illness, and 38% were in optimal mental health with high levels of happiness and social and psychological well-being. Past research has largely focused on remission from alcohol dependence. We sought to understand the whole continuum of recovery. We wanted to know what factors were associated with flourishing, not merely remission, says first author Melissa Redman, assistant professor of social work at Carleton University. The high levels of resilience that we found are encouraging for those who are alcohol dependent, their family and loved ones, and for professionals in the field. Alcohol dependence is one of the leading causes of preventable deaths in the United States. Approximately 88,000 Americans die from alcohol-related causes every year, with nearly a third of all driving fatalities linked to alcohol-impaired driving. In the U.S., excessive alcohol use has been linked to close to $250 billion in economic losses annually. Considering the personal, communal, and economic consequences of alcohol dependence, there needs to be a greater understanding of factors associated with both remission and recovery, and corresponding improvements in mental health, relationships, and quality of life. Redman and her colleagues found social support to be strongly associated with remission from alcohol dependence and achieving optimal mental health. Additionally, among those with a history of alcohol dependence, each decade of age was associated with more than a 30% higher odds of remission from alcohol dependency and optimal mental health. With greater age, individuals often experience lower impulsivity, more family and work responsibilities, and a concomitant increased understanding of the negative impact that alcohol dependence has on quality of life, employment, family life, and social relationships, says co-author Esme Fuller-Thompson, professor at the University of Toronto's School of Social Work. Older individuals may have moved away from the social circles and alcohol-dependent social situations of their youth, which would make decreasing alcohol use easier. Okay, next up, I want to highlight health policy briefing from the Health Policy Institute of Ohio. This one is the connections between criminal justice and health. I'm just going to cover a couple highlights of this, and if you're more interested in this, you can go online, and I have a link to the full report, and that's the same link that I'll give at the end of the show with the bonus reads. Okay, here we go. Connections between criminal justice and health. There is a two-way relationship between criminal justice and health. Mental health and addiction challenges can lead to arrest and incarceration, and incarceration contributes to poor behavioral and physical health for many Ohioans. Racism and community conditions contribute to criminal justice involvement and poor health. Racist and discriminatory policies and practices and community conditions such as poverty, housing instability, and exposure to trauma lead to increased criminal justice involvement and drive poor health outcomes. Improvement is possible. There are evidence-informed policy solutions to combat the drivers of criminal justice involvement and poor health outcomes. And a couple examples under the category of taking action, with the policy goal of support mental well-being and improve crisis response for people at higher risk of criminal justice involvement. An example solution would be increase the number and effectiveness of crisis intervention teams, establish programs that dispatch medical professionals to behavioral health crises, and require crisis de-escalation training for all first responders. And another example of a policy goal, improve health for people who are currently or formerly incarcerated. An example policy option would be expand the use of telehealth in jail and prisons, including medical management of behavioral health conditions and consistent and accurate dispensing of medications. Next up, this from Medical Express. The link between structural racism, high blood pressure, and black people's health. High blood pressure, structural racism, what do they have in common? Researchers say they are two of the biggest factors responsible for the gap in poor heart and brain health between black and white adults in the United States, and they are inextricably linked. Studies show high blood pressure, also called hypertension, affects black adults, particularly women, earlier and more dramatically than their white peers. By age 55, research shows 3 of 4 black adults have already developed the condition, compared to about half of white men and 40% of white women. Untreated, high blood pressure can lead to a range of disabling and potentially fatal chronic diseases, including heart disease, stroke, dementia, kidney disease, sexual dysfunction, and loss of vision. Behind these elevated risks, researchers say, are a complex web of negative influences stemming from the multi-generational impacts of structural racism. Chandra Jackson, a research investigator and epidemiologist with the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, considers structural racism as the totality of ways in which societies foster racial discrimination through mutually reinforcing systems of housing, education, employment, wages, benefits, credit, media, healthcare, and criminal justice. These patterns and practices in turn reinforce discriminatory beliefs, values, and the maldistribution of health-promoting or harming resources, she said. That is, they create the physical and social environments that make it easier for white families to grow up healthy and harder for black families to do so. For example, decades of discriminatory lending called redlining have kept black families segregated in neighborhoods with fewer resources and greater chronic exposure to environmental hazards, such as unclean drinking water and noise and air pollution, Jackson said. These neighborhoods also tend to lack quality healthcare facilities and providers, grocery stores that sell healthy and affordable foods, or open spaces where adults can exercise and children can play, she said. Discriminatory employment and educational systems result in higher levels of poverty that create financial strain, housing and food insecurity, strained relationships, and less access to good health insurance. All of this, along with the daily indignities of racial discrimination, increases stress. That, in turn, may be associated with increased blood pressure, said Augustine Kang, an investigator at Brown University School of Public Health. All these factors set up the perfect storm for disease. Overall, black men and women report higher levels of stress than their white counterparts. But studies show black women who experience the compounding effects of both race and gender discrimination, along with the chronic stress of having to work harder to overcome this dual bias, pay a particularly high price with their health starting early in life. Black women have shorter life expectancy than white women, in part due to higher rates of heart disease. Stress also makes it harder to manage heart and brain health risk factors, such as high blood pressure, once they take hold. King led a study that found black women with high blood pressure who experienced high levels of stress were substantially less likely to take medication or practice blood pressure-lowering behaviors such as exercising or eating a healthy diet. Lifestyle factors are incredibly important in managing blood pressure, he said. There are social and environmental factors that present an added barrier to diet and physical activity, which accounts for a lot of the health disparities we see today. We cannot rely just on the efforts of individuals and doctors, he said. You need a well-functioning healthcare delivery system. Asking people to improve their diet when they don't have access to healthy foods, to exercise when they don't have access to safe or affordable spaces, to take blood pressure medications when they can't afford them, while also failing to ensure access to quality universal health care, will never succeed in limiting health inequities, said Dr. Manica Safford, founder and co-director of the Cornell Center for Health Equity. She also is chief of general internal medicine at Cornell Medical College. We can't leave it up to individuals. It's not their fault. The system is set up to fail them. The system is not fair, equal, and equitable. Here's an interesting article from Medical Express. Study suggests unmedicated, untreated brain illness is likely in mass shooters. The first analysis of medical evidence on domestic mass shooters in the U.S. finds that a large majority of perpetrators have psychiatric disorders for which they have received no medication or other treatment, reports a study in the Journal of Clinical Psychopharmacology. Without losing sight of the larger perspective that most who are violent are not mentally ill, and most of the mentally ill are not violent, our message is that mental health providers, lawyers, and the public should be made aware that some unmedicated patients do pose an increased risk of violence, according to the report by Ira Glick, MD of Stanford University School of Medicine, and colleagues. The researchers identified 115 persons identified as committing a mass shooting in the United States from 1982 to 2019, based on the most comprehensive listing available, which was the Mother Jones database. The database excluded shootings related to, quote, conventionally motivated crimes, such as armed robbery or gang violence. In the vast majority of the incidents identified in the database, the perpetrator died either during or shortly after the crime, the researchers note. I just want to editorialize a little bit and just emphasize this. The vast majority of the incidents identified in the database, the perpetrator died either during or shortly after the crime. Now, this makes it harder to evaluate a person when they're already dead, of course, for this study, but it's a really important thing because a lot of these mass murders, these mass shootings, are actually suicides as well. Often cases, the shooter takes their own life. Of course, in some of the cases, the police take the life of the shooter in a shootout. Okay, they focused on the 35 cases where the assailant survived and underwent criminal proceedings, providing the best information on their symptoms of mental illness and psychiatric state. Based on the data, 32 of the 35 perpetrators had signs and symptoms of brain illness, which fit scientific diagnostic criteria for a clinical psychiatric disorder. 18 of the shooters had schizophrenia, while 10 had other diagnoses, including bipolar disorder, delusional disorder, personality disorders, and substance-related disorders. Of the 28 surviving assailants with a psychiatric diagnosis, none were medicated or received other treatment prior to the crime, the researchers write. They also analyzed 20 mass shooters who died at the crime scene, using available data from the media or significant others. 8 assailants had schizophrenia, 7 had other diagnoses, 5 had unknown diagnoses. Similarly, none were receiving appropriate medications. Okay, well, this adds some insight into the proverbial and perennial question when shootings happen, why? And of course, accents each and every call to improvement in our mental health system in this country. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And we're in the middle of a greatest hit show with timely and timeless public health stories. Well, let's switch gears and get to some stories about the food system. This from Civil Eats. The food system's carbon footprint has been vastly underestimated. A new analysis pins one-third of global greenhouse gases on the food system by including long-overlooked factors such as transportation, packaging, and waste. A paper recently published in Environmental Research Letters found the global food system was responsible for 16 billion metric tons of greenhouse gas emission in 2018, or a third of all global emissions that year. This is a sharp contrast to the more narrowly defined agriculture sector of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. These categories, the categories for greenhouse gas inventories, which accounted for 5.3 billion metric tons in 2018, or just a tenth of the total, according to the IPCC. To be clear, this analysis doesn't add to the total global greenhouse gas emission. Rather, it simply collects all the food-related emissions in one place in an attempt to accurately illustrate the true size of food's carbon footprint. And it reinforces a 2020 research paper that found avoiding catastrophic climate change will be impossible without radically cutting emissions from the global food sector. The new analysis accounts for those emissions that the IPCC allocates to non-agricultural categories, including carbon dioxide from pre-production, like manufacturing fertilizer and farm equipment, and post-production emissions such as food waste disposal, refrigeration, packaging, and transportation. It also includes, as food-related emissions, the conversion of natural ecosystems to agricultural land, which is at nearly 3 billion metric tons per year, are the single largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in their analysis. So again, to accent that last point, the change in our physical environment of going from a natural ecosystem to this monoculturing of agriculture, which is largely what our agricultural is, that right there accounts for 3 of the 16 billion metric tons and is the single largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the food sector. The total health and climate consequences of the American food system cost 3 times as much as the food itself. The U.S. spends $1.1 trillion a year on food, but when the impacts of the food system on different parts of society, including rising healthcare costs, climate change, and biodiversity loss are factored in, the bill is around 3 times that, according to a report by the Rockefeller Foundation, a private charity that funds medical and agricultural research. Using government statistics, scientific literature, and insights from experts across the food system, the researchers quantified things like the share of direct medical costs attributable to diet and food, as well as the productivity loss associated with those health problems. They also looked at how crop cultivation and ranching and other aspects of the U.S. food production impacted the environment, focusing on the production, processing, distribution, retail, and consumption stages of the food system, not including food service. They evaluated what it would cost to restore people's health, wealth, or environment back to an undamaged state, as well as the cost of preventing a recurrence of the problems. Realizing a better food system requires facing hard facts. We must accurately calculate the full cost we pay for food today to successfully shape economic and regulatory incentives tomorrow, asserts the introduction of the report, written by the Foundation's Food Research Group. Health impacts are the biggest hidden costs of the health of the food system, with more than $1 trillion per year in health-related costs paid by Americans, with an estimated $604 billion of that attributable to diseases, such as hypertension, cancer, and diabetes, linked to diet. In calculating the financial burden of environmental problems, the researchers evaluated direct environmental impacts of farming and ranching on greenhouse gas emissions, water depletion, and soil erosion. They also looked at reduced biodiversity, which lowers ecosystems' productivity and makes food supplies more vulnerable to pests and disease. They determined the unaccounted cost of the food system on the environment and biodiversity add up to almost $900 billion per year. The report examines 14 metrics, health, environment, biodiversity, livelihoods, and more, to quantify what it calls the true cost of food, reflecting additional externalized costs incurred within the food system not covered by the price of food. These externalized costs are being incurred by the public sector, businesses and producers, consumers and future generations, the report argues. Across many of the areas, communities of color bear a disproportionate burden. This report is a wake-up call. The U.S. food system as it stands is adversely affecting our environment, our health, and our society, said Rajiv Shah, president of the Rockefeller Foundation. To fix a problem, we need to first understand its extent. The data in this report reveals not only the negative impacts of the food system in America, but also what steps we can take to make it more equitable, resilient, and nourishing. If an organic apple is 99 cents and a sugary beverage is also 99 cents, there are layers of subsidies in that sugary beverage. We need to examine not only what we're paying, but what that price reflects, the subsidized costs and the external costs, diabetes, obesity. You can quantify the health impact, she said. Dariush Mozafarian, Dean of Tufts University School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy, who was an advisor on the report, said that the pandemic, coupled with the Black Lives Matter and the reawakening around racial justice, has been a, quote, September 11th moment around food. We're at a tipping point. People widely recognize that the food system is broken, adding the most current public policies around food and agriculture are based on the 1969 White House Conference on Food, Nutrition, and Health. Yet 52 years later, much of it doesn't make sense. The priority in the 1950s was to get calories into the world because the world population had quadrupled. At the same time, the best nutrition information we had was about vitamins. Vitamin deficiency have largely disappeared. We were successful, but we didn't anticipate the explosion of obesity, he said. According to the report, if U.S. rates of diet-related diseases were reduced to similar rates in countries like Canada, healthcare costs could be reduced by $250 billion per year. This would require the food industry to focus on creating healthier foods and adhering to more rigorous regulations for the marketing of unhealthy foods, said Roy Steiner, Senior Vice President of the Food Initiative at Rockefeller Foundation. We created the food system with a particular objective, low cost and abundant calories, and we didn't understand what that impact was going to be, said Steiner. Separately, the report also suggested the U.S. could reduce agricultural greenhouse gas emissions to keep the global temperature increase below 1.5 degrees centigrade of pre-industrial levels, then some $100 billion could be saved in additional environmental costs. Melissa Ho, a senior vice president of the World Wildlife Fund and also an advisor on the report, said that while people are increasingly aware of the connection between diet and health, they have trouble understanding the connection between the food system and environmental damage. She would like to see more performance-based metrics and tools to assess things like how much carbon a farmer or rancher is returning to the soil. We must shift our farming practices and systems to be more regenerative and resilient. We can do this if we realign and shift our public policies and programs to support producers and drive this transition from the ground up, she said. Based on the way the system is set up right now, she said, it's not easy or lucrative for farmers to transition to less harmful agricultural practices, such as not tilling or using cover crops that help build soil and prevent erosion. COVID exposed so much that was broken, she said, but building back better means supporting producers and connecting the dots to health, environment, and business viability for farmers. And this from Scientific American. Pesticides are killing the world's soils. Scoop up a shovel of healthy soil and you'll likely be holding more living organisms than there are people on the planet Earth. Like citizens of an underground city that never sleeps, tens of thousands of subterranean species of invertebrates, nematodes, bacteria, and fungi are constantly filtering our water, recycling nutrients, and helping to regulate the Earth's temperature. But beneath fields covered in tightly knit rows of corn, soybeans, wheat, and other monoculture crops, a toxic soup of insecticides, herbicides, and fungicides is wreaking havoc, according to a newly published analysis in the journal Frontiers in Environmental Science. The study, the most comprehensive review ever conducted of how pesticides affect soil health, should trigger immediate and substantive changes in how regulatory agencies like the EPA assess the risks posed by the nearly 850 pesticide ingredients approved for use in the U.S. Currently, regulators completely ignore pesticides' harm to earthworms, springtails, beetles, and thousands of other subterranean species. Our study leaves no doubt that must change. For our analysis conducted by researchers at the Center for Biological Diversity, Friends of the Earth, and the University of Maryland, we looked at nearly 400 published studies that together conducted over 2,800 experiments on how pesticides affect soil organisms. Our review encompassed 275 unique species or types of soil organisms and 284 different pesticides or pesticide mixtures. In just over 70% of those experiments, pesticides were found to harm organisms that are critical to maintaining healthy soils, harms that currently are never considered in the EPA's safety reviews. The ongoing escalation of pesticide-intensive agriculture and pollution are major driving factors in the precipitous decline of many soil organisms, like ground beetles and ground nesting bees. They have been identified as the most significant driver of soil biodiversity loss in the past decade. Yet pesticide companies and our pesticide regulators have ignored that research. The EPA, which is responsible for pesticide oversight in the U.S., openly acknowledges that somewhere between 50% to 100% of all agriculturally applied pesticides end up in the soil. Yet to assess pesticides' harms to soil species, the agency still uses a single test species, one that spends its entire life above ground in artificial boxes to estimate risk to all soil organisms, the European honeybee. The fact that the EPA relies on a species that literally may never touch soil in its entire life to represent the thousands of species that live or develop underground offers a disturbing glimpse of how the U.S. pesticide regulatory system is set up to protect the pesticide industry instead of species and their ecosystems. What this ultimately means is that pesticide approvals happen without any regard to how these pesticides can harm soil organisms. To add to this, the principles of regenerative agriculture and soil health gain popularity around the world. Pesticide companies have jumped on the bandwagon to greenwash their products. Every major pesticide company now has web materials touting its role in promoting soil health, often advocating for reducing tilling and planting cover crops. As general principles, both of these practices are indeed good for soil health and, if adopted responsibly, are great steps to take. However, pesticide companies know that these practices are often accompanied by increased pesticide use. When fields aren't tilled, pesticides are often used to kill weeds, and cover crops are often killed by pesticides before crop planting. This one step forward, one step back approach is preventing meaningful progress to protect our soils. Pesticide companies have so far been successful in co-opting healthy soil messaging because our regulators have demonstrated no desire or willingness to protect soil organisms from pesticides. The long-term environmental cost of that failure can no longer be ignored. Soils are some of the most complex and biodiverse ecosystems on the planet, containing nearly a quarter of the planet's diversity. Protecting them should be a priority, not an afterthought. Our research indicates that achieving this will require that we face the task of reducing the world's growing and unsustainable addiction to pesticide-intensive agriculture, and it will require that the EPA take aggressive steps to begin protecting the health of our soil by addressing the well-documented harms of pesticides to our long-overlooked subterranean species. Next up from the Washington Post, the total health and climate consequences of the American food system cost three times as much as the food itself. The U.S. spends $1.1 trillion a year on food, but when the impacts of the food system on different parts of society, including rising healthcare costs, climate change, and biodiversity loss are factored in, the bill is around three times that, according to a report by the Rockefeller Foundation, a private charity that funds medical and agricultural research. Using government statistics, scientific literature, and insights from experts across the food system, the researchers quantified things like the share of direct medical costs attributable to diet and food, as well as the productivity loss associated with those health problems. They also looked at how crop cultivation and ranching and other aspects of the U.S. food production impacted the environment. Focusing on the production, processing, distribution, retail, and consumption stages of the food system, not including food service. They evaluated what it would cost to restore people's health, wealth, or environment back to an undamaged state, as well as the cost of preventing a recurrence of the problems. Realizing a better food system requires facing hard facts. We must accurately calculate the full cost we pay for food today to successfully shape economic and regulatory incentives tomorrow, asserts the introduction of the report, written by the Foundation's Food Research Group. Health impacts are the biggest hidden cost of the food system, with more than $1 trillion per year in health-related costs paid by Americans, with an estimated $604 billion of that attributable to diseases, such as hypertension, cancer, and diabetes, linked to diet. In calculating the financial burden of environmental problems, the researchers evaluated direct environmental impacts of farming and ranching on greenhouse gas emissions, water depletion, and soil erosion. They also looked at reduced biodiversity, which lowers ecosystems' productivity and makes food supplies more vulnerable to pests and disease. They determined the unaccounted cost of the food system on the environment and biodiversity add up to almost $900 billion per year. The report examines 14 metrics, health, environment, biodiversity, livelihoods, and more, to quantify what it calls the true cost of food, reflecting additional externalized costs incurred within the food system not covered by the price of food. These externalized costs are being incurred by the public sector, businesses and producers, consumers and future generations, the report argues. Across many of the areas, communities of color bear a disproportionate burden. This report is a wake-up call. The U.S. food system as it stands is adversely affecting our environment, our health, and our society, said Rajiv Shah, president of the Rockefeller Foundation. To fix a problem, we need to first understand its extent. The data in this report reveals not only the negative impacts of the food system in America, but also what steps we can take to make it more equitable, resilient, and nourishing. If an organic apple is 99 cents and a sugary beverage is also 99 cents, there are layers of subsidies in that sugary beverage. We need to examine not only what we're paying, but what that price reflects, the subsidized costs and the external costs, diabetes, obesity. You can quantify the health impact, she said. Dariush Mozafarian, Dean of Tufts University School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy, who was an advisor on the report, said that the pandemic, coupled with the Black Lives Matter and the reawakening around racial justice, has been a, quote, September 11th moment around food. We're at a tipping point. People widely recognize that the food system is broken, adding the most current public policies around food and agriculture are based on the 1969 White House Conference on Food, Nutrition, and Health. Yet 52 years later, much of it doesn't make sense. The priority in the 1950s was to get calories into the world because the world population had quadrupled. At the same time, the best nutrition information we had was about vitamins. Vitamin deficiency have largely disappeared. We were successful, but we didn't anticipate the explosion of obesity, he said. According to the report, if U.S. rates of diet-related diseases were reduced to similar rates in countries like Canada, healthcare costs could be reduced by $250 billion per year. This would require the food industry to focus on creating healthier foods and adhering to more rigorous regulations for the marketing of unhealthy foods, said Roy Steiner, Senior Vice President of the Food Initiative at Rockefeller Foundation. We created the food system with a particular objective, low cost and abundant calories, and we didn't understand what that impact was going to be, said Steiner. Separately, the report also suggested the U.S. could reduce agricultural greenhouse gas emissions to keep the global temperature increase below 1.5 degrees centigrade of pre-industrial levels, then some $100 billion could be saved in additional environmental costs. Melissa Ho, a senior vice president of the World Wildlife Fund and also an advisor on the report, said that while people are increasingly aware of the connection between diet and health, they have trouble understanding the connection between the food system and environmental damage. She would like to see more performance-based metrics and tools to assess things like how much carbon a farmer or rancher is returning to the soil. We must shift our farming practices and systems to be more regenerative and resilient. We can do this if we realign and shift our public policies and programs to support producers and drive this transition from the ground up, she said. Based on the way the system is set up right now, she said, it's not easy or lucrative for farmers to transition to less harmful agricultural practices, such as not tilling or using cover crops that help build soil and prevent erosion. COVID exposed so much that was broken, she said, but building back better means supporting producers and connecting the dots to health, environment, and business viability for farmers. And lastly, on the food systems from Food Politics blog, the food system is unfair to real farmers. This study in Nature Food caught my eye. Post-farmgate food value chains make up most of consumer food expenditures globally. The study examines the proportion of at-home food expenditures received by farmers in several countries, including the U.S. So in 2008, 11.6% of food costs actually go to farm and agribusiness. 22.6 cents on the dollar go to food processing and packaging. 13.6 cents, that is more than what goes to the farm and agribusiness, actually goes to the retail trade, basically your grocery stores and such. And then in the restaurant sector, when you're talking about food services, 33.7%, almost over a third of the food dollar goes to food service. Again, 11.6 cents for farm and agribusiness. Okay, all but about 12 cents of every food dollar goes for processing, retail, food service, and everything else that happens to a food after it is produced. As the authors of the Nature Food Study put it, there's already growing agreement that the most unhealthy foods are largely ultra-processed products that are high in such ingredients as salt, sugar, and saturated fats. That is manufactured post-farmgate. In the average American diet, for example, only about 30% of calorie intake comes from non-processed or mildly processed foods. Ultra-processed foods also occupy a rapidly rising share of diets in developing countries as consumers seek greater convenience and safety. The environmental impacts of ultra-processed foods have not been properly accounted for in many studies, often considering the effects of the primary commodities used for production and disregarding the processing, packaging, and distribution stages. Likewise, the post-farmgate food processing sector is a major source of single-use plastics, greenhouse gas emissions, water use, and effluent discharge. We and the planet would be healthier eating foods that are less heavily processed. This would not only be good for us, but also for the farmers. Okay, we're going to switch gears here a bit and move on to mental health. And this is a really great article from Mad in America. And I'm just going to read some excerpts. And of course, you can go onto the website, which I'll give at the end of the article, so you can see the full article online. Researchers critique the medical model, propose an alternative. In a new article, researchers lay out a cogent critique of current practices in mental health care and propose a paradigm shift based on existing successful alternatives. Despite the overwhelming increase in psychiatric services, there has been no improvement in outcomes for people diagnosed with mental illness. Rather, outcomes have only worsened since the dawn of the medication era. For instance, the number of people taking long-term prescriptions continue to rise, as do the suicide rate and the rate of disability due to, quote, mental illness. The overwhelming focus on biology and mental health research, the authors write, has failed to address the primary goal psychiatric research should serve, helping patients. The progress in neuroscience does not seem to translate into better treatments, and new drugs are no better than those discovered by accident in the middle of the 20th century and work on the same underlying principles. They note that the United Nations has recently focused on critiques of biomedical psychiatry, particularly on the work of the UN Special Rapporteur, Danais Pures. For instance, Pures, in his report on the right of everyone to the enjoyment of the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health, writes that mental health systems worldwide are dominated by a reductionistic biomedical model that uses medicalization to justify coercion as a systemic practice and qualifies the diverse human responses to harmful underlying and social determinants, such as inequalities, discrimination, and violence, as, quote, disorders that need treatment. That is, biomedical explanations of distress encourage people to see their emotions as random sputterings of imbalanced chemicals in the brain, rather than as the natural response to trauma and other social factors like poverty or racism, or even situations like stressful work or problems in romantic life, all of which has been shown to lead to distress far more than any hypothesized chemical has. One particularly worrying consequence of this is the fact that some people with psychiatric diagnoses may even lose the ability to understand their mental states as something that is directly connected to the lives they live. If someone sees their distress as due to workplace harassment, for example, they may try to change jobs. But if they think it's their, quote, broken brain is the problem, they may feel powerless to ever escape that distress and focus on treating their, quote, mental illness with drugs rather than changing that problematic life situation. Perhaps more importantly, when society views distress as an individual biomedical problem, then issues like social inequality, structural racism, student loan debt, etc., can all be put on the back burner. More funding will go to individual medical care, usually drugs, and less funding will be used for fixing structural societal problems. Thus, the cycle continues. Understanding psychiatric disorders is primarily consequences of various life circumstances and their meanings for individuals would require a radical reshaping of mental health care. Generally, our thinking about using psychiatric drugs could follow the principles of harm reduction, as in the case of illicit drug use, not only in the cases of withdrawing, but as a guiding principle. Drugs should be used voluntarily, as all other services. Otherwise, speaking of service users is merely a linguistic distraction. Someone who is treated against their will is neither a user nor a consumer and rely on an actual informed consent. Diagnoses could be considered to be the primary source of stigma, self-stigma, power imbalances within a psychiatric system, and an excuse for forced treatment and violations of human rights that effectively produce second-class citizens. Instead of diagnoses, the author suggests a more humanistic framework could be used. But even just a simple focus on the person's specific experiences, rather than trying to fit them into a diagnostic label, could be better. We should be asking questions such as, what has happened to you? How did it affect you? What sense did you make of it? What did you have to do to just survive? Instead of going over symptoms checklists to arrive at diagnosis. Okay, you can see this full article at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. And this from Science Daily. Think leisure is a waste? That may not bode well for your mental health. Feeling like leisure is wasteful and unproductive may lead to less happiness and higher levels of stress and depression, new research suggests. In a series of studies, researchers examined the effects of a common belief in modern society that productivity is the ultimate goal and time's a wasting if you're just having fun. Spoiler alert, having fun is good for your health. People who most strongly agreed with this belief that time's a wasting if you're just having fun not only enjoyed leisure less, but also reported poorer mental health outcomes, said Celine Malcock, co-author of the study and associate professor of marketing at Ohio State University College of Business. There's plenty of research to suggest that leisure has mental health benefits and that it can make us more productive and less stressed. But we find that if people start to believe that leisure is wasteful, they may end up being more depressed and more stressed. That was true whether the leisure activity was active, such as exercising, or passive, such as watching TV, or social, such as hanging out with friends, or solitary, such as meditating. In addition, the more they thought leisure was wasteful, the lower their levels of happiness and the higher their levels of depression, anxiety, and stress. The negative view of leisure is not just an American issue. One study which compared people in the United States, India, and France found that the French were less likely than those in the U.S. and India to believe leisure was wasteful, as is consistent with cultural stereotypes. But for those in France who did disdain leisure, the bad effects were the same. We live in a global society and there are people everywhere that hear the same messages about how important it is to be busy and productive. And once you believe that and internalize the message that leisure is a waste, our results suggest you're going to be more depressed and less happy no matter where you live. The researchers were struck at how the negative views of leisure affected enjoyment of anything fun, no matter the situation or how short the leisure activity was. For those who believe leisure is wasteful, it may be helpful to think about the productive ways that individual leisure activities can serve their long-term goals. In other words, connect each leisure activity to something you want to accomplish, she said. Find ways to make fun activities part of a larger goal in your life. Think about how it is productive, instrumental, and useful. But of course, while you're doing that, get rid of the notion that productivity is the center of health. Relaxation plays a critical role. So just relax, folks. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-